Stand by for action.
All rise for Air Zone Podcast 38.
Pleasure to welcome you to AR Zone podcast number 38 with our special guest, Professor Stephen M. Wise. Joining us today will also be fellow AR Zone admins Tim Geyer, Ronnie Lee, and Roger Yates. Professor Wise, described as America's best known animal lawyer, has practiced animal protection law for over 30 years. The first person to teach a class on animal law at Harvard Law School, Steve has taught animal rights law or animal rights jurisprudence for more than 20 years. Steve's written four books, including Rattling the Cage, Toward Legal Rights for Animals, and Though the Heavens May Fall, the landmark trial that led to the end of human slavery. And he's collaborated with leading scientists in the fields of primatology and animal intelligence and behavior. Formerly president of the Animal Legal Defense Fund, Steve is most recently the founder and director of the Non-Human Rights Project. The project is fighting in the USA for the legal rights of animals other than humans, working to break through the legal wall that separates humans from non-humans, thereby gaining legal personhood for all who deserve it. Hi, Steve. Thanks for being here with us today.
I am delighted.
Steve, I'd like to start straight away in reference to the Non-Human Rights Project and the concept of personhood. Would you please explain what legal personhood would mean for other animals and why your legal work has been focused on the so-called higher animals such as chimpanzees and dolphins?
Well, legal personhood is the capacity of an entity to have legal rights. Sometimes I describe it as a container. I imagine that a being is a glass, and and you can have a pitcher full of rights. In order to pour those rights into a person, you have to have a container. And so the glass is the container. So when someone is a legal person, they are a container for rights. They have the potential for having a legal right. And if you're not a legal person, you're a legal thing, and you don't have the potential for any legal rights. And if you are a person, you do have that potential. So the reason why we at the Non-Human Rights Project are trying to gain personhood is because that's another way of saying we're trying to get rights for non-human animals. You asked about why we focus. I think you talked about higher animals, but you don't really talk about higher animals. We're talking about getting legal rights right now for any one legal right for any one non-human animal. The reason is that now when we're recording in May of 2012, no non-human animal has a legal right. No non-human animal is a legal person, while every human being is a legal person and has an infinite number of rights. So I describe it as a wall sometimes, this kind of thick, high jurisprudential wall that doesn't let rights go from humans to non-humans. So right now, if you're trying to ascertain whether an entity has a legal right, is a legal person, you simply need to know her species. If she's a human, then she has rights. She's a person. If she's a non-human, then she doesn't have rights and she's not a person. And we in the Non-Human Rights Project are trying to breach that wall and have a common law high court right now in the United States, one of the 50 states, declare that any non-human animal is a legal person, that is, has the capacity for at least one legal right. And we think that by doing that, we will then be able to change the questions asked from what species are you to what kind of a being are you? Are you the kind of being who ought to be a legal person, who ought to have the capacity for legal right? And if so, what legal rights should you have?
Thanks, Steve. In relation to that, back in February this year, PETA was trying in the US courts to get orcas recognized as falling under the protections guaranteed by the 13th Amendment to the US Constitution. I think I got that right. For those of us outside the US, would you please explain what PETA's suit entailed and why your organization was opposed to it?
Well, PETA's suit appeared to be a claim that an orca or orcas, several orcas, were slaves within the meaning of the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution. We in the Non-Human Rights Project thought that was an exceedingly bad idea on numerous grounds. One is that PETA filed that suit in federal court and in the United States, and for many reasons, and some of which PETA was finding out, the way the federal rules of civil procedure go, it makes it very hard to proceed. The substantive law in federal court can be very hard. And also the final appellate court is the United States Supreme Court. And we don't have any reason for thinking that the United States Supreme Court is sympathetic in the least to the idea that not only does an orca have a, not only are they not slaves within the meaning of the 13th Amendment, but that they have any rights at all, that they're legal persons at all. You need to, when you're beginning to litigate the personhood or the capacity of a non-human animal for rights, you need to start at the legal place, the jurisprudential place that is the easiest to win. And years ago, the Non-Human Rights Project talked about this and decided that the common law, the Anglo-American common law that is used in all of the American states except for Louisiana, was the best place to start for many reasons. It's inherently flexible. That is a major reason. Also, it's not a statute. It's not a constitution. So a judge or judges are not put in the position of trying to interpret what the intent was of the legislature or the body that passed that statute or passed that constitutional amendment. Instead, common law judges have the duty and the privilege of being able to fashion the common law in a way that takes into account modern morality, modern scientific findings, modern experience. So those are the kinds of arguments that we intend to make when we bring suit under the common law. Probably the very worst place to begin would be with the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, or perhaps even the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which says persons are entitled to due process or and equal protection. Because then you have a judge, which as PETA found out, going to look at what the 13th Amendment means, going to the legislative intent, finding that there was no legislative intent when it was enacted in 1865 to include any non-human animal, but that it was enacted to end human slavery. To the folks in the Non-Human Rights Project was extraordinarily obvious. And we at some time hope that once we're able to establish common law rights and then perhaps other sorts of rights in the United States, that perhaps 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now, we'll be able to work our way up to the apex, which is to say that a non-human animal, perhaps an orca, might be entitled to a constitutional right, perhaps as a slave under the 13th Amendment, as a person under the 14th Amendment. But that's really the capstone to an immense amount of sophisticated litigation. It's not the first place to start, because if you start there, you'll get slapped down immediately, which is what happened to PETA. Now, they can get slapped down immediately, but we were also concerned that they didn't understand that they were going to run into the problem of capacity to sue, of legal personhood, and that we were concerned, and that concern was confirmed by PETA's memos, that they might end up trying to claim that an orca was a person or had the capacity to sue under California law. We did not want that to happen because we thought if that was brought before the judge would almost certainly rule that an orca did not have capacity to sue under California law. And frankly, California is a jurisdiction that the Non-Human Rights Project has been looking at very carefully. for years now as a place to file our first suits. And the last thing we wanted was to have a negative decision on California law come down, because that could then harm the litigation that we've been planning for so many years.
Thank you for explaining that, Steve.
Steve, as sort of a follow-up to that, first, it sounds that what people probably understand from watching Perry Mason when you and I might have been children, or watching Law and Order today, and we have an idea of how we think the law works, we really don't have much of an idea, do we?
No.
Yeah. When you wrote the book, Though the Heavens May Fall,
yes,
is the story you tell in that book about the ruling in Britain that ended, or that was a ruling against the legality of slavery, and that was in 1772, and so then, but it took another 60 or so years before slavery was abolished in the British colonies. But can you talk about the way that process worked that you found in the case of human slavery, and what that sort of means as we look forward? You mentioned just a minute ago that 30 or 40 or 50 or more years as a timeline of what we might expect in the struggle for non-human rights.
Well, the reason I wrote Though the Heavens May Fall was as a template for the kind of litigation that the Non-Human Rights Project is doing. I wanted to show how it was, and it was a heck of a mess, you know, but I wanted to show how it was, all of the influences, all the politics, all the law, all the cultural pressures, that human slavery was essentially abolished in England by judicial opinion, by Lord Mansfield. And so while I don't give my own opinion as to what's going on, and I never make the connection between black slaves and non-human animals in Though the Heavens May Fall, I certainly set out many times in which the actors themselves, the lawyers and the judges and others, they made the connections between black slaves and non-human animals. And I show how any legal thing, any being who is a thing who doesn't have any rights, as opposed to a person who has the capacity for all kinds of rights, how they might use the judicial process for being able to become a legal person. And that's exactly what happened to James Somerset in Though the Heavens May Fall. He became free, and essentially slavery took an enormous step to being abolished. Now, while it's somewhat controversial, I believe, and many people agree with me, that Lord Mansfield, in the Somerset case, which was the focus of Though the Heavens May Fall, abolished slavery in England. And so from that time on, there was no slavery. However, it did not apply to the English colonies. That had to be abolished through parliamentary statute. And as you know, it took into the mid-1830s for that to happen. But this was really the first, you know, shot off the bow of slavery all over the world. And it was indeed the case that was the beginning of the end of human slavery everywhere. So what the Non-Human Rights Project is doing is similar to what James Somerset's attorneys wanted to do. We are looking for a sympathetic, or at least not a hostile, high court. And in the United States, there are 49 possibilities, which is one of the reasons why our work takes so long. We do legal research, we come up with a legal problem, and then we have to research every single one we do through 49 states. So we've probably come up with 30 or 40 different standards that we're trying to compare from state to state. So if we have 40 and we're multiplying it by 49, that means we basically have almost 2,000 individual research projects, and we have 60 people working on this. But it's still an enormous amount of work, and we've been working on it. We're well into our fourth year now, but we're almost finished. We indeed plan on filing our first suits in a common law jurisdiction in 2013, probably the last quarter of 2013. So what we're doing is trying to file to find the best high court in which we can try to induce those judges to do the right thing and the legal thing, which is to find that our non-human animal plaintiff is a legal person, has the capacity for rights. And once we can do that, and then we'll go on to the next right, we'll go on to the next non-human animal. We are planning on winning, we're planning on losing, we're planning on everything in between, and we're just going to keep up a drumbeat of litigation, you know, year after year after year, until we succeed in really breaking through that wall. Once we break through that wall, and indeed a common law High Court has found that our non-human animal plaintiff is a legal person with the capacity for at least one legal right, well, then we predict that we're not going to be able to predict much about what's going to happen. There's going to be an enormous amount of cases that begin to get filed. Even if we lose, we're still going to be filing other cases. We'll keep going until we're able to win. But then we feel confident that legislatures will step in. Some of them will step in on our side. Some of them will step in and try to block us. But this first case in which people realize that it is indeed possible that a non-human animal can be a legal person, that's really kind of punching a hole through this jurisprudential wall I've been talking about. And then from then on, it's kind of like a battle. You can plan as much as you want, but you know, once the battle starts, it's really hard to predict the course of it.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It seems that, again, I mean, I think that the common impression is that laws get changed because someone's on the side of right and someone's on the side of wrong. But from what I hear you saying, it's not just a matter of having the winning argument. You have to have the winning argument in the right place at the right time in front of the right judge and so on and so forth. And that sounds immensely complicated.
It is immensely complicated. You know, judges are nothing special. They're just like your mom and dad and your wife and your children. You know, they're just normal people who happen to be judges. And so they are, you know, deeply embedded in our culture, whatever culture that is, just like everyone else is. And we fully expect that we aren't going to win in front of judges who haven't been exposed to our arguments, you know, 5 times, 10 times, 20 times. We have to begin that process somewhere. We have to begin it somewhere. And one of the ways we're doing it is we're beginning to publish a series of law review articles on all of the issues that we're talking about. And the first one came out at the end of 2010, and now we're working on about 7 or 8 of them simultaneously. So we're trying to get those out so judges and their clerks will see them. We try to write books that get reviewed in law reviews that and begin to immerse judges, like everyone else, with the kind of arguments we're making. And again, we don't necessarily expect to win the first time that a judge sees it, but perhaps we might. Some of them we might, but the second time or the third time or the fifth time or the tenth time. We're also very concerned about making the kinds of arguments that judges have been educated in, that they're steeped in, that they use every single day. So we're not trying to create a new way of arguing. What we're trying to do is fully understand what sorts of arguments judges will accept. And then we're framing our arguments in those terms.
Steve, going on to something entirely different, can I sort of go back to basics and ask you what it was that first caused you to become interested in protecting other animals and what led you to become vegan?
1980, I read Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation, and at that point I was a practicing lawyer for probably 4 years. And of course, well, not of course, but I had become a lawyer because I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer. And I'd come out of the Vietnam anti-war movement as well, and these things were important to me. And when I read Peter's book, I wasn't even a vegetarian. It struck me that these beings needed more help than anyone I'd ever seen. And if what I wanted to do was to make some kind of a difference in lives, reduce suffering, increase the amount of justice in the universe, that there was nothing I could do that would be better than to become an animal rights lawyer. And so that's what I became. Although in public, I call myself an animal slave lawyer because I believe I practice animal slave law in that non-human animals are slaves. And so what I tell people is that as a lawyer, I practice animal slave law, but as a professor and as a writer and as a speaker, I talk about a kind of law that does not yet exist, which is animal rights law or animal rights jurisprudence, but that it's actually arriving a lot more rapidly than I would have thought. As far as my dietary habits, everything came from Peter's book, but I hadn't really thought about it. And once I started thinking about it, I just kind of went in steps. First, I stopped eating. I remember I stopped eating mammals, you know, and then I stopped eating chicken, and then I stopped eating fish, and I would just kind of go in steps over a period of years.
I'd like to ask you a question about abortion, actually. In the U.S., as in Australia as well, abortion obviously is quite a contentious issue. And for almost 40 years, your country has been polarized by this moral issue and the laws concerning it. No matter how much public debate there's been, the US seems unable to come to terms with abortion. Do you see any lessons that we can learn about whether making the moral argument for animal rights is likely to work?
Well, the intersection between making moral arguments and making legal arguments is not clear. You know, in some areas of the law, there really is no intersection at all between morality and legality. In some areas of the law, they seem to harmonize quite closely. Abortion is a particularly, you know, thorny problem because it's a rights issue in which there are, you know, two entities involved. You have the fetus and you have the mother, and they might have opposite interests. So I really view that as a unique problem. I think the problems that I look at as more closely attuned to what we're doing have been the first 150 years ago, the arguments about ending slavery, which worked well, I mean, 200 years ago in the UK, but you know, in the US it did not work well, and we only ended after a terrible civil war. I look at the long argument against racial discrimination, and I'm watching it appear in front of my eyes as I watch gay marriage move from state to state, with some states permitting it, some states opposing it, some states passing constitutional amendments that say you're not allowed to have it. And then last week, the remarkable day in which back to back, you had the North Carolinians vote to amend their constitution to prohibit gay marriage, and the president of the United States comes out in support of it. I'm a real believer in tides of history, and I have no doubt that animal rights is riding a tide of history and that it is going to happen, and we just have to jump in and we have to start it. Luckily, it doesn't have the immensely thorny problem of having a fetus and a mother, you know, kind of two entities bound together who can sometimes have opposite interests, because the reason that people are so upset about it is because they focus on different parts of that equation. Those of us who are pro-choice look at the mother. Those folks who are pro-life look at the fetus, and there's simply no way of accommodating those interests in any easy way.
Thanks, Steve.
One of the things that we hear in this country, in America, is that activist judges forced the issue of abortion on the people rather than letting the state-by-state process working its way through the way that gay marriage is working its way through. Is there a danger that the type of work that you're doing would lead to people having that feeling about activist judges that's such a problem in this country?
Well, people might say it, but it would be people who don't understand how the common law works. When you look at abortion, that was a result of a decision in Roe v. Wade, which is a decision under the 14th Amendment to the United States. The question was whether a fetus was a, quote, person, unquote, within the meaning of the 14th Amendment. You had the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, by 7-2 ruling, say that they were not. And you could see why some people might not have agreed. Obviously, the court itself was split. But there's a very big difference. And in fact, this kind of goes back to my concern about the PETA case. That you don't want to file suit in a federal court claiming that a non-human animal is a person under the 14th Amendment or is a slave under the 13th Amendment, because then you run smack into the problem that you are talking about. You're talking about having activist, quote, activist, unquote, judges. And an activist judge, I really see, is a judge who rules the way you don't like. If a judge rules the way you do like, then she's not an activist judge. She's just doing the right thing. But the beauty of the common law is that it does not involve an interpretation of a statute. You can't have an argument about what the legislature mean, or you should say that the court should not rule in that area, but should let the legislature do it. The common law is, by definition, law that's made by judges. And so it's their job to make the law. And a good common law judge, and there are lots of them, and there are some who aren't that hot either, but a good common law judge, or even a great one like Lord Mansfield in the Somerset case that ended slavery in England in 1772, they will indeed change the common law when science has changed, when people's experience have changed, when public morality changes. They will do it. That's their job. And so to say that they're an activist judge is rather silly, because it's a misreading about what the role of a common law judge is.
You're listening to AIRZone Podcast number 38 with special guest Professor Stephen Wise.
Steve, you've spoken about the common law, but would you say that the ultimate aim would be to actually get legislation to protect animals?
Well, law is so complex. I think that the common law is a really great place to start. But also, there's still an immense amount of common law. At one time, law was almost all common law, but there's still a lot of common law. And you know, what a common law judge says is the law. What a court says remains the law, until and unless the legislature steps in and does something about it. Again, I can go back to the Somerset case in 1772. Lord Mansfield was very hesitant to decide that case. And he indeed asked the slave owners to go to Parliament to get a statute passed, and that would take the burden off him. They wouldn't do it. Both sides saw the Somerset case as a test case. And so then what he did is he ruled against the master and in favor of the slave, and then they did go to Parliament. The slave interest did go to Parliament, but they couldn't get a statute passed that would overturn Lord Mansfield's opinion. And we're expecting that something like that could also happen. We could win at a common law level, and perhaps the losing party could go to the legislature and try to have the legislature overturn our victory. They might and they might not, but if they don't do it, then the ruling of the court would hold, and we would not need statutes. But there's nothing that stops a legislature from jumping in, and we think that once we start winning these kinds of cases, legislatures are going to be jumping in all over the place, either to extend our rulings or to try to void our rulings. Who knows? We're just going to have to wait and see. It's certainly going to reflect evolving public morality. And certainly it's going to be a large fight, but it's the kind of fight that we saw for slavery issues, for racial discrimination issues, for female discrimination issues, for gay marriage issues. It's a long, difficult, brutal fight. But we're trying to begin the process. We're trying to begin the process in the judicial arena in a way in which we have a reasonably good chance of actually winning.
It seems, therefore, that it's important also that we have the right sort of politicians in power, because they can either refuse to go against the common law, or they can overturn the common law. So would you say that animal protection campaigners should be involved in the political process in order to create more sympathetic politicians, more sympathetic legislatures?
Yes, it's absolutely mandatory. Lawyers can only do so much. If we have somehow lightning struck and we manage to do something that the people of that jurisdiction did not like, well, they can fight back, which is actually what happened when the Iowa Supreme Court a few years ago found that there was a right to gay marriage under the Iowa Constitution. There was a recall campaign, and three of the judges were thrown out of office the following year. You can do that. You can impeach judges. You can amend constitutions. You can pass statutes that void victories. There's all sorts of things that can be done, pro and con. One of the pros and cons of litigating in the United States, as opposed to England, for example, is there's really just one judicial system in England. But in the United States, there's at least 52. There's all 50 states. There's the District of Columbia. Probably there's Puerto Rico. There's there's the federal system. And they all have different kinds of jurisdictions and different kinds of powers. So, you know, for good or ill, you have a lot of choices. And if things don't go well for you in one state, then you can try in another state, which is what happens, right? Right now, probably have 30 states that have either constitutional provisions or legislation that prohibits gay marriage. Well, I think now you have 7 states, I believe, that permit it.
Steve, when we were talking about the PETA case earlier, you were talking about the drawbacks from that approach, from the tactical side. Are there drawbacks to the approach that you're taking?
If you don't really think it through, you can always make a bad situation worse. And so what we do in the Non-Human Rights Project is to try to figure out how to frame our litigation so that we can win as broad a victory as possible, and that if we lose, we lose as narrowly as possible. It's possible, though, you know, once you get a case in front of a court, that court, if they don't like you, they can do all sorts of things that you might not have expected or wanted. It's the kind of litigation that's the least likely to lead to bad outcomes. The PETA case was the kind of litigation that's most likely to lead to bad outcomes, which is what we were concerned about. By the way, we were very pleased. You know, we asked PETA if they would be so kind as to not appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I don't know if they paid any attention to us, but we were very pleased when they did not, because that then isolated their case as a decision of a single judge in Southern California, as opposed to the entire Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is, you know, really one of 12 courts of appeals.
And the reason that's important is because of precedent?
Yes. Yes. There's, I don't know how many federal judges there are. There's probably 500 or 600 federal judges, but there's only say 12 courts of appeals. So it's easier to try to get over a bad precedent if it's simply one of 500 or 600 judges, as opposed to one court of appeal out of 12.
Gotcha.
Steve, in Rattling the Cage, the book begins with a chapter called "The Problem with Being the Thing." So I wanted to ask you a question about the property status of other animals. You say, and as you said before in the podcast, that humans are legal persons, other animals are legal things, and you say in the book that without legal personhood, one is invisible to civil law, and without civil rights, one may as well be dead. So what's your take on the importance of challenging the property status of other animals? How are we going to do it? Is that a specialist job for animal rights lawyers, or can we all, as animal advocates, help in some way? You know, what's your general feeling about challenging the property status?
Well, the sorts of cases I'm talking about filing are direct challenges to the property status of non-human animals. It's possible that we could win a case and have a court declare that a non-human animal is a legal person but is also property. That is theoretically possible. We think it's unlikely, but it's theoretically possible. And even if that occurred, we would think we'd won a smashing victory, because we had gotten a high court to concede that a non-human animal was a legal person with the capacity for rights. It just might have happened that they didn't agree that the right that we were arguing that our non-human animal plaintiff should have, she does have. Then we would have to try again. But clearly, in fact, my thinking about it has evolved in the last 12 years since Rattling the Cage came out. And at that point, I was thinking in terms of either property status or non-property status. And now I realize that it's possible for us to find a slightly intermediate place where we could argue that, and we might persuade, of course, that a non-human animal was a legal person and not a thing, had the capacity for rights, and perhaps had the capacity, say, not to be vivisected, but did not have the capacity not to be owned. We would be surprised if that happened, but we think it's theoretically possible. So it's not so much, I think, the idea of property status, which is what I thought 12 years ago. It's really the idea of personhood. Are you a container that do you have a capacity for rights? And so once we get a court to agree that a non-human animal is the kind of being that has the capacity for any right at all, then we can bring subsequent cases and try to establish one right after another as we're trying to kind of probe the boundaries of what rights our non-human animals should have. And it's also very possible that courts could find that one kind of animal, say a chimpanzee, has more or different rights than another kind of animal. You know, say an orca, or say a firefly or a frog, it may not have any rights at all. Or an orca could have certain kind of rights because, you know, she swims in the ocean, or a chimpanzee might have certain kind of rights because of how he's put together. It's quite a complex undertaking, and what we're trying to do is really establish that first principle, which is that it is possible for a non-human animal to be a legal person, and that is have the capacity for a legal right. And then we start arguing as to what rights they should have.
Yes, and I think that the different types of animal and different types of interests, as it were, I think that was a position that was brought up by Mary Midgley in the 1980s.
Yes.
I wanted to explore an issue that, following on really from what Tim was saying about activist judge, which is it's not a familiar term for me from a European perspective, but it's an interesting one. And you were talking about finding a judge, and you're looking around, and you've got a team of people looking in particular at each individual state and et cetera, et cetera. But you also said something very sociological, or at least kind of rung my sociological bell, if you like, which is that judges are nothing special. In other words, they, along with everybody else, are embedded as much as, you know, anyone else in the culture of society, and society is speciesist. So that leads to that issue, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is the argument about, you know, should we not be concentrating on cultural change first before we can hope to make a dent in what is essentially a speciesist system? Or, you know, do you take the position that you can do a bit of both at the same time?
I take the position that we should be doing both at the same time. The only reason that I think that the time has come for the Non-Human Rights Project to be able to file a lawsuit that has some reasonable chance of success is that I think our culture has changed. I've been an animal protection lawyer, animal slave lawyer now for 32 years, and the differences that I have seen from a legal point of view are dramatic. You know, people don't bark when I walk into a courtroom. They haven't done that in about 20 some years. They understand if I stand up and tell a judge, you know, I'm an animal protection lawyer, I don't usually tell judges I'm an animal slave lawyer, but I could say I'm an animal rights lawyer to them. They know what I'm talking about. When Rattling the Cage came out, it did just what I wanted to in the year 2000. It catalyzed, you know, an enormous storm of legal commentary in the U.S. Law reviews, magazines, judges and lawyers were talking about it. There were conferences about it. And that's only grown. When I first started teaching animal rights law at the Vermont Law School in 1990, if there were one or two other classes, I'd be surprised. Now they're taught at 140 law schools. There's 5 law reviews. There are numerous people who are bringing legal challenges involving non-human animals in every state all the time. I think that we've reached the first possible moment in which we have some reasonable chance of winning. And therefore, we want to grab that and we want to push forward as hard as we can. You know, I take it very personally and very seriously. I think in 2003, I wrote in Drawing the Line that in the United States, something like 400 animals died, non-human animals died every time my heart beats. And, you know, we live with that every day. And we know that every day, every month, every year, you know, there's an enormous amount of pain being inflicted, enormous amount of slaughter going on, and that we feel a moral obligation to move as quickly as we can without doing something intemperate or foolish so that we actually set back what we're trying to accomplish. I think we have determined now that the earliest possible moment for some reasonable chance of success has arrived.
Yeah. I mean, I get this distinct impression listening to you talk about your work and through your books that you're thinking on a kind of tactical level quite often. And in some senses, it reminded me of what Tom Reagan did with the case in 1983, where he made the case for mammals of 1 year and over and made the case for moral rights. And he was really essentially looking for an uncontroversial, or at least a relatively uncontroversial starting point on which you can found the case. is that what you did kind of legally, in the sense that you went for the strongest cases, as you say?
Yes.
And that in theory would open the floodgates once you kind of punch the hole through this wall that you talk about, that this would open the floodgates for other animals. So it's a kind of tactical thing to go for a particular type of other animal first. Is that right?
Well, yes, we are hoping to win. I think perhaps as lawyers, we really want to win. We don't like to lose. And we are trying to, as I said, either file suits that will allow us either to win as broadly as possible, but if we lose, to lose as narrowly as possible. And we're not thinking about just filing one suit. The Non-Human Rights Project is intended to be a permanent litigating organization. So we're talking about simply filing our first suits, and as we get enough money, we get enough people, we watch cases that are coming down, then we intend to be filing as many suits as we possibly can well on into the end for decades. And the object always is to win. We have no intention of going down with flying colors or kind of giving each other a high five and say, boy, that was a really good try. We intend to win.
Yes, I understand. And I understand the kind of tactical side of things. In fact, in the run-up to your podcast, we listened to an old tape from 2001 when you did a BBC interview. I don't know if you remember it. It's called The Moral Maze, where you crossed swords with this odious English guy called David Starkey. In that program, you were talking about this kind of tactical idea of going for a particular type of other animal first, but making it clear that the other animals were involved as well. And so it then, because I know that in terms of the movement, you kind of got in some hot water with when you wrote Drawing the Line, because it appeared to some people that you're excluding some other animals from protection. I'm imagining that what you would say is that you weren't doing that, but you were just concentrating on who comes first. Is that right?
It is right. We are trying to bring the cases that we have the best chance of winning. And we don't think that bringing cases on behalf of chickens or behalf of farm animals are going to be those cases. In fact, we are certain that if we're in front of a court and a court thinks that, say, by holding that a cetacean is a legal person, automatically everyone's going to have to be a vegetarian. We're not going to win that cetacean case. And we're not going to stand up and do and say things that are going to undercut later cases, but we're going to start with the cases that we think we have the best chance of winning. It is tactical. That's what we do as lawyers. It was always rather disturbing to me that people did not grasp that. I think when Rattling the Cage came out, I was accused in some quarters of chimpnocentrism because I was just talking about chimpanzees and bonobos. And I didn't quite know how to deal with that, since it seemed to be obvious that indeed that was what the book was about, but that was not what our theories were about.
Steve, can you talk for a minute about practical autonomy then in the context of this? It's correct me, please. I know you will if I'm wrong, but it seems that practical autonomy is, if I remember from your AR Zone interview that you did online with us, I was reading the transcript, and practical autonomy is what a judge will recognize such that they'll realize that a particular non-human should be afforded rights under the law. But a minute ago you said it may be the case that frogs, for example, are never afforded rights under the law. Are we looking forward to a situation where it just may be the case that because of the types of beings that different non-humans are, that some of them will fall under a rights paradigm, a legal rights paradigm, and some of them won't?
I'm glad you asked that question. The idea that autonomy can lead to rights is really the idea that autonomy is a sufficient condition for rights, that a being who is autonomous, who has what I call practical autonomy, should then become a legal person and should be entitled to certain kinds of fundamental rights. But I only argue that autonomy is a sufficient and not a necessary condition. And that is clearly so, because there are many humans who are not autonomous at all, and yet they have rights. And what I argue is that autonomy and those non-human animals who are highly autonomous should be the position so that they're in the they have the best shot of getting rights and gaining legal personhood, that as a sufficient condition, but not as a necessary condition for rights. So there may be other reasons, and I'm sure there are other reasons, other conditions under which any being, a human or non-human, should be entitled to rights. And I'm just arguing that autonomy, what I call practical autonomy, is simply one sufficient condition. There may be other sufficient conditions, but I don't talk about them. Was I clear on that? Because oftentimes people don't understand.
You were clear to me, yes, sir. I appreciate that. And again, this is because what you're doing is that you're trying to make the best possible legal case that you can win.
Yes,
correct?
And what the Non-Human Rights Project is concerned about, what its main purpose is to have any common law court declare that any non-human animal is a legal person and can have any legal right. At that point, we believe we will have changed the legal discourse from, you know, are you a human and therefore you have rights, to are you the kind of being, irrespective of your species, who should have rights? And if so, what rights should you have? And we think changing that question is the most important thing that we can do.
Very good. I'm out of questions.
That's good.
Steve,
I'm out of answers.
There was a question actually that I wanted to ask. You know, just about every interview that you've ever been in, Steve, you talk about your twins, and the interviews that I have,
yes,
there were about three then. So how's your twins?
Well, now they're 14.
Wow. And so real trouble then, yeah.
And I got divorced and I remarried, and my wife had a daughter that was 10 days younger than my twins. So now I have three 14-year-olds, which is why if you could see me, I would look like hell.
Wow. Yeah, I'm surprised you can just speak without screaming or anything. That's great. That's great.
I love them all to pieces. Not only are they all 14, but they're all 14 in totally different ways.
And would you still kill the rest of humanity for them, which is the argument that you used before?
In a second.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought that was such a powerful argument when you said all that proves is that fathers love their daughters. It doesn't prove anything in general legal terms.
It does not, or moral terms. It just means you keep those kinds of decisions out of the hands of people who are really affected by it.
Yeah.
Steve, I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with us today. It's really been a pleasure and a very interesting discussion. And I thank you also for explaining the work of the Non-Human Rights Project more to us. I think you're doing some really important work there. And I wish you the best of luck with it in the future. So thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate the thoughtful and detailed questions.